Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Bet Amud Bet. The Mishnah says, Shomer Chinam Enu Nishba. Shomer Chinam does not take a Shbua on the items that are listed in our Mishnah, Abadim, Shtarot, Karkaot, Vekdeshot. The Gemara wants to know, Minahane Mile. How do we know that that's the case, or where do we learn that from? The Tanur Rabbanan. Because the Psukim say, here we're going to quote from Parshat Mishpatim. In Parshat Mishpatim, there are three Parshiot of you can tell from the nature of them, but the Gemara itself notes that the first one is speaking about a Shomer Chinam, the second one is speaking about a Shomer Sachar, and the third one is speaking about a Shoel. So by the case of the Shomer Chinam, it says, Ki yitein ish el re'eu klal, kesef o kelim prat, lishmor chazar uchlal, klal prat uchlal, yetadan el keina prat. You have a klal prat uchlal, you look for the common denominator between the pratim, and that dictates what goes on here. Ma prat mifurash davara mitaltel begufo mamon. Common denominator between them is that they are movable objects, non-real property, begufo mamon, and they have integral value to them. Af kol davar amitaltel begufo mamon. Yatsu karkaot, that excludes karkaot she'ein mitaltelim, because they're real property, fixed assets. They don't move. Yatsu abadim shukshu the karkaot. That excludes abadim who have a hekesh to karkaot because of the psukim at the end of Sefer Vayikra, which say v'intchaltem otam nivnechem acharechem, that you would treat them like real property and give them over as inheritance to your children. Yatsu shtarot sh'af apishim mitaltelin, shtarot which do have the feature of being movable items, nevertheless ain gufan mamon. They have no integral value to them. All their value is the intangible from what is written in them or what they represent, not their integral value. Hekdesh is also excluded because it says Itein ish el re'eyu. Re'eyu is your fellow man. Re'eyu k'tiv and not Hekdesh. So that is the exclusion in Shomer Chinam for the Shbu'ah on those three items as well as on Hekdesh. Yoseh Sachar inu mishalem. The Mishnah also noted that a Shomer Sachar does not pay. And again, I'll note here that it's not that if a Shomer Chinam had to pay, or if a Nosei Sachar had to take a Shvuah, that this wouldn't be true as well. What the Balei Tosafot noted yesterday is that the Gemara just picks them in the order of the Parshiot HaTorah. Shomer Chinam comes first, then Shomer Sachar. Shomer Chinam, the Parsha favors him taking a Shvuah to be exempted from Geneva Vaveda. So it speaks about Shvuah in that context. Shomer Sachar pays for Geneva Vaveda. He only gets an exemption for Ones, for a case where it was out of his control. But nevertheless, if the Shomer Sachar is found in a case of Ones and he'd have to take a Shvuah, he'd be the same as the Shomer Chinam and he wouldn't take a Shvuah. Or if the Shomer Chinam was found in a position where he would have to pay, then also he would be exempted just like the Nosei Sachar is exempted. And that led us to the discussion yesterday in the Balei Tosafot with regards to Pshia, where the Balei Tosafot believed that a Pusheya is Patur here, because they are exempted from having to pay or take a Shvuah on these items. And that means even a Pusheya, according to the Balei Tosafot. And we saw the Rambam who disagrees with that and says a Pusheya is a Mazik. He's not within the world of Shomrim anymore. He took himself out of the world of Shomrim and made himself into a Mazik. And therefore Pusheya is Chayav in these instances. So now the Gemara says, Minolon, how do you know by Nosa Shachar that you do not pay? Like for instance, if there was Geneva Vaveda with one of these items, how do we know that he's not responsible to pay? Minolon, the Tanur Rabbanan, Kiteinish, Ereu, Klau, Chamor, Oshor, Ose, Prat, Bechol Beima, Lishmor, Chazar, Vichlau. So now you have a Klau, Uprat, Uchlau, and then Vichule. Where it says, look above at Shomer Chinam, and you'll know what the Vechule is, which is the common denominator between them is that they are Davar Mitaltel and the Gufo Mamon. So too, everything that is a Davar Mitaltel and Gufo Mamon, which would exclude the three items, Karkot, Avadim, and Shtarot, and then Hekdesh, Re'eyu Ktiv. Once again, it says Kitenish El Re'eyu, and Re'eyu is to the preclusion or the exclusion of Hekdesh. So that's how we learn the same Klal Uprat Uchlal by Shomer Sachar. And again, it applies to all of Shomrim. This exemption, both from Shvuah as well as compensation, applies to all of the Shomrim. But we brought the examples from Shomer Chinam and Shomer Sachar. Rabbi Meir Omer, Yesh Dvarim Shein Kekarka, Veinan Kekarka. Rabbi Meir says that there's some things that have a status, or they look like karka, But nevertheless, their halachic standing is not of karka. So michlau, the Rabbi Meir savar kol mechuber lekarka, ainu kekarka. Anything that's attached to the ground, according to Rabbi Meir, is not deemed to be karka. At the mifkalei bit to unot, then why argue about grapevines that are loaded with grapes? Liflegei bisrukot. You can argue about pear grapevines. You can argue about anything attached to the ground. Why did he specify grapes that are mature in the argument in the Mishnah? Amar Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, hocha ba'anavim omdot libatzer kamiflegei. So this is found in other places in Jas, but here we're speaking about grapes that are ready to be picked. They've reached full maturation, and they're ready to be taken off the tree. The Rabbi Meir Savar, kibitzurot damyon, Rabbi Meir considers them as picked, and therefore they are no longer considered to be karka, or mechuber the karka. Rabbanan Savar, lo kibitzurot damyon, that they are not considered to be picked, and therefore they still have, or deemed to have, the same status as the karka, or the status of mechuber the karka, or as the karka. So first of all, even within this disagreement between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, the Gemara in other places notes it really depends maybe on how far they are along in the maturation process, which is that it might be that even the Chachamim agree that if leaving the grapes on the vine is detrimental, they'll start to rot, then even they will agree that they are kibitzurot damyon. Now Tosafot points it out here, he's more explicit in other places in Shas, but we have numerous expressions like this throughout Shas, which is kol ha'omed litalesh, everything that is ready to be picked or taken out or be separated, we look at it as if separated. A hair that is ready to be cut is as if it's cut. Or kol ha'omed lifroa, anything that's supposed to be paid, we consider kiparua, as if it is paid. All these expressions throughout Shas, where when something reaches a point where it no longer needs the item it's attached to, that we consider it as if it is detached. So, all of these expressions in Shas, what Tosafot says is, they are not a unified position. You could believe that one of them is true and the other one is not true, and you have to look at it in each circumstance or each situation. And he points out over here that that's the case. He says, Dele inyan Shabbat, l'kuliyama lav kibitzirot damyon, uke mechubarot. Nobody will say that if you go pick these grapes on Shabbat, that you are patur. Nobody would say that. Everybody believes they are attached for the dinim of Shabbat. Even though now you're telling me it's as if picked. If it's as if picked, why isn't it considered to be talush? That's not talush. Talush means separated completely. So for the Shabbat, it'll be mechubar. But for the issue here of whether it's karka or not, gilgabei shvua, there's a machloket as whether they're attached or not attached. And he notes as well, ulinyan balchov, when it comes to a creditor, since they don't need the land anymore, they don't need to be there, they're no longer considered to be collateral for the debt. Real property is collateral, not things that are attached to the ground that no longer need the ground. So he's pointing out that even though here we have a machloket, in other places in Shas, you would not necessarily exercise the same thing. So here Tosafot says it about the same idea, kibitzurot damyan, but even in other areas of halacha, we don't look at it as kol ha'omed l'gzoz, because gazuz dummy, all these concepts are totally separate, and therefore you can't extrapolate one to the other, even though he does point out that Rabbeinu Chananel claims that some places in Shas, that the Gemara is following the Shita of Rabbi Meir, which would indicate otherwise, which means that he thinks that Rabbi Meir is being applied in other places, and that's why the halacha is this way. The Baalei Tosafot think that that is not the case, and that we paskin like other Tanaim, even like the Rabbanan over here, but can still have alternate opinions in other places in Shas. They're not all correlated. So now the Gemara says, Ein nishbayim ela davar shebimidash mishkal ubiminyan. The Mishnah says that you can only take a shvua on something that is defined. First of all, where does the Gemara get this from? The fact that you do need to have a defined item? So if you look in the Baalei Tosafot over here, it says, Perish Rivad, nearly Mahided Ashinim Peresh Mirube, that it comes out of Salma, Lemu'ute Davar She'inu Misuyam. So a Salma, which is one of the items mentioned by the Shomer Kinam, was that comes to exclude something that is not defined, something that is not a clear object. Behainu, Shalob Emida Mishkal Meminyan. Umiyu Yesh Mifashim Sham Perush Acher. Da'ati Lafuke Chatzi Rimon Chatzi Egoz, that they use it for something else over there. And then, how do you have it that the case here is a case of Davar Misuyam? So, Rishonim point out is because the Pasuk says, Ki yitain isha re'eyu kesef o kelim. And just like kesef and kelim are defined items and defined objects, so too, whatever the claim and the denial are, they must be within that realm of defined objects. So that's just, first of all, in terms of the source for this fact, which Gemara does not ask for over here. Amar Abaye, lo shanu ela da amar lei bayit stam. The Mishnah contrasted that with the case where a person says that I gave you a bayit malay or I gave you a kis malay, and the other guy says, I don't know, I'm giving you back whatever you gave me. Bayit says that that's only applicable if he just generically says, I gave you a house full, or I gave you a pouch full of something. If he says, I gave you this house full of whatever it is, then his claim is defined, because he's specifying the house in which the item is, and that means that you know what it means to be full. If that's the case, or by that you're right, in the sefer where it says, when there he makes a claim that it was until that protrusion or the board that sticks out, and the other one says, no, it was only up until the window, chayav, there's a case where there is a defined argument over here, and you're chayav b'modah b'miksad, liflog v'litna v'dida, make a much finer distinction even within the statement before. The only case where bayit malay doesn't work is because you said generically a house full. About bayit zeh malay, had you said this house full, chayav, that would have been a case of modeh b'miksad. Why doesn't the Mishnah make that finer distinction according to you, Abaye, instead of going to something that's more far-fetched, which is to the protrusion or to the window? Tosafot points out that when we say liflog v'litna v'dida, Rova's question, Abaye, his question is more pronounced because obviously in the case when you say adaziz or adachalon, we're not talking about some generic house. You have to be speaking about a specific house because otherwise how do you know what it means until the ziz or until the chalon? So that must be that he's seeing a bayit zeh. And despite the fact that the Mishnah is saying bayit zeh, it still goes to ziz and chalon. It doesn't allow you just to say bayit zeh. The ulam einu chayav. Or in essence, what Rava says is, Abaye is wrong over here. Even if you say bayit zeh malay, it's not considered to be a defined enough so that you can force a shvat modeh b'miksat. So now, just a couple of notes over here. The Abaye Tosafot discussed, v'im tomar, hamay lo choshev bayit zeh malay, davar shebimida. Why when you say this house that is full, or this pouch that is full, why is that not considered to be a davar misuyam? You know what that is now. We've defined the house. We know that it was full. V'yesh lamar. So he answers here, it is a common problem today. B'she'ein chaseira ela ma'at mikrei meleya. Sometimes when something's not full to the top, it's still considered to be full. V'en yadua ma b'nehem. And now we don't know the difference between the claimant and the defendant. Inami b'inin she'eskir mida b'hodato. There are two possibilities. Either Tosafot says you need to mention in your admission that there was something defined, and that doesn't happen here. The guy says, I gave you a house full, and he says, I'm giving you back whatever it is that you gave me, or this is what was full for me, and he never mentions what the deficit was. But the more interesting Tosafot is the one before. I'll give you an example of this, which is that when you rent a car, you have to bring the car back with the tank full. How do you define what it means to have the tank full? There's no gas station in the car rental place. You have to fill it up with gas somewhere else. How far away you fill up that last fill up will determine how full the car is. And when they give you the car, they say they gave you a tank full. Yet the dial isn't all the way at the top. It's a little bit off the top. That is exactly what the Bayit Tosafot are pointing out. The definition of full can be different for different people depending on whose perspective you're taking it. And therefore you never know what it means to be chasera or deficit because you can say that's full, and the guy says that's not full, and you can have an argument about what full is. And that's what Tosafot says in the end. It's not a defined item because full is very subjective. When it's missing a little, it's still considered to be full. Or if it's full to the top, it's also considered to be full. And that's the problem here of why it's not defined is because there's no exact measurement or definition as to what this item is. That's the way the Bayit Tosafot discuss it. The Ritva, on the other hand, notes that the difference or what Rava's opinion relies on is whether it can be determined from outside of the area. Which means that if you can, sitting in Beit Din, know what they're speaking about and understand what the statement meant in terms of Araziz, Arachalon, because you don't need to be in the house to understand where are the rafters in the house, where is the window in the house. You may have to see how much the exact deficit is, but you can understand that their claim and the defense are different, or the admission and the claim are different. If someone says, I gave you a house full, another guy says, no, you didn't give me a house full, there's no way that the Dayanim, without walking to that house, can know what he's talking about, unless if you say Bayitzeh. And that's the way the Ritva looks at it, and he says, we want something that's in the court, you can know right away that there's a difference in their claim and admission, versus something where you're going to have to go to the object itself and then investigate to see whether full or not full, what does that mean, how high was that, how much was that. That's even if you tell them what house it is, you still don't know until you go to that house. So that's how the Ritva explains that position of Rava. Tanya Kavote de Rava. We have a bright and supportive Rava's position. Kor Tvua Li Biadecha. I have a kor worth of grain in your possession. Va'omer in the Chaviyadi. No, you don't. Patur, that's a kofer bakol. Minorah Gdola Yesh Li Biadecha. I gave you a large candelabra in the Chaviyadi. Ela Minorah Ktana. You only have a small menorah in my hands. Patur. Now, the tour over here is because there are two different items. The hoda'ah is not minatana. You're talking about a big candelabra, a small candelabra. Claim is for something that has nothing to do with the admission. Azorah gudola yeshli biyadecha. You have a large belt that I lent you. In the chabiyadi, elo zorah ktana. You only have a small belt. It seems that in their day, they had hollow belts that went around, and so it was a belt and a money pouch at the same time. The equivalent of a fanny pack that people carry around, smaller, but it was a hollow belt. So he says, I gave you a large one. And he says, no, you gave me a small one, patur. Again, seemingly the problem is that the admission has nothing to do with the claim because they're not a subset of each other. A big belt and a small belt, or a big candelabra and a small candelabra, are not subsets of each other, two different objects. Aval amarlo kur tvua yeshli biyadecha. He says, I have a kor worth of tvua that I gave to you, which is 30 sa'ah. V'alau meri in the chabiyadi ala letech. You only have a letech, which is half a kor or 15 sa'ah. Then chayav, that's modeh b'miksat. Menorah bat eser litrin yeshli biyadecha. I have a menorah that weighs 10 litra worth of kesef that's in your hand. In the chabiyadi ala bat chamesh litrin. No, the menorah you gave me only has 5 litra of kesef. Chayav. He is chayav. Klalo shel davar. What is the principle underlying this? Olam ene chayav. Achit enu bedavar shemidah mishkal ubeminyan. The claim has to be for something that is fixed in number. V'yodelo bedavar shemidah mishkal minyan. And then you admit to it. Klalo shel davar latuye mai. The principle that's laid out at the end of the Mishnah, what does that come to include? Lav latuye bayit zemalei. It must be to come to tell you that bayit zemalei doesn't work. Umayishna minorak dola umnorak tana. Wait a minute. Why minorak dola minorak tana mashita ano lo hodalo umashodalo lo tano? Over there, why does the Mishnah give the example of the big menorah and the small menorah? As we noted, the problem is the fact that they have nothing to do with each other. It's speaking about two different objects, not a subset of the larger object. If that's the reasoning, bat eser bat chamesh nami. If you have a menorah that is 10 litrin and a menorah that's 5 litrin, just because you define the size of it, you still have a problem because it's not a subset of the larger menorah. 10 and 5 is the same as saying big and small, just you define it better what big is and what small is, but you still end up with a disconnect between the claim and the admission. Mashatano, lohodalo, mashodalo, lotano. Amar Rav Shmuel bar Yireb Yitzchak, acha b'menorah shel chuliot askinan. Here we're dealing with a menorah that is made up of pieces or parts. You put it together, it is a menorah that you can, like equivalent of a Lego, or assemble or disassemble, so you can make it bigger or larger depending on how many, let's say, arms you want coming off of it, and how tall you want it to be. You can put different pieces in it in order to make it different. And that means that it can be a subset. The 5 litra can be a subset of the 10 litra because it depends how many chalakim, how many pieces you put in this menorah that is assembled of pieces. The kamodale mina, because then there's an admission that is a subset. By the case of gdolan ktana, the failure is that you did not give a defined amount. Those are relative words that have no meaning in an objective context. Big and small are all relative to each other. There's no defined claim and defined oda. Eser litrin and five litrin give you an exact amount. You know what the claim was for. You know what the mission was for. But you also can be a subset because it's a menorah that's made out of parts that can be assembled and disassembled to make it bigger or smaller. If you're right about that, wait a minute. You have to pay careful attention in the Braita, but the Braita gave three examples in the Reisha and only two examples in the Seifa. In the Reisha, it spoke about a kurt vua, then it spoke about a menorah gdola ktana and a zor gdola ktana. In the Seifa, it gave two examples. Kor versus a letech in tvua, and then a menorah of eser litrin and a menorah of chamesh litrin. What does not appear in the Seifa is a belt, the ezor. Why does that not appear in the Seifa? You could do the same thing that you did with the menorah, you could do with the belt. But look, maybe the life feet. You can do it with a belt that has attachments on it. And then each attachment that you add on makes the belt bigger or smaller. And so if he makes a claim for a belt that has this length to it, and the other guy says, no, it's a shorter belt, but a belt that has these attachments that you can add on, then you can shift the size of the belt. And then you'll have a dolag tana that you can define by size, and that could be a subset of it. So why doesn't the Braita give that example? Ella, the lifei lo ktani. So that's because the lifei are not written. So hachanami b'shel kol yot lo ktani. If you can't use a belt that is expandable and contractible, so too, you can't speak about a menorah that is expandable or contractible based on the pieces. And therefore, it says, since it didn't write about the nazorah of lifei in the Braita, it clearly wasn't thinking about a menorah of kuliyot. And even though, as David Fah points out, that's a pretty weak answer, because you could just say it's subsumed under the case of menorah, nevertheless, the Gemara knew that it had a better answer. El Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Mamel, then how do you explain the menorah in the Braita? Shiny menorah, hold the gorerah, ulamidal chamesh litrin. If you have a menorah that is a solid candelabra made out of 10 litrin, you can file it down and have it be 5 litrin in the end. You can reduce it from 10 to 5, and you can still have the same original menorah be cut down to the level of 5. That is not true by the belt. And the question is, why by the belt can't you have it be cut down? The way Rashi explains it over here is because Bezorah Lekele Meimar Chatach Emenu Sharei Rosheha Nikarim, because then it will be visible on the ends. And then the Rimigash adds on top of that that not only is it visible to cut, but you actually have to take action in order to deal with it, which is you have to stitch up the end. So the reasoning given by the Rimigash is because when you cut a belt, and this is true today as well, they deal with it in a different way today. But when you have a belt that is a flexible belt, most belts today come at a size, and then you cut it down to the waist size that you need. Once you cut the piece down, the finish on the end where you cut it is no longer there. So you have to do something with that unfinished part of the belt. In their day, that means you have to stitch it or sew that end in order to fix it. So you can't just cut it and say, oh, I have a smaller belt from a bigger belt. You actually have to do something then. You actually have to work on it in order to make the smaller belt functional again. Today, they put that piece inside the clasp, so you don't see it, and therefore it's not an issue. But in their day, where everything was visible, both ends were visible, that end that you cut, you would have to then stitch or you'd have to shape again in order to make it work. So for that reason, you can't do the same thing by a belt, and that's why it wasn't mentioned in the Braita. And then if that is the case, then the deficit by the menorah gdola and ktana is not because it's an undefined item, but rather because the hoda'ah is not miminatana. And that is because making something from a tall menorah to a small menorah either destroys the item, and you can't do that, or it's just not considered to be a subset. Now, once you've established that, the Rashash, using the Balei Tosfot here and the Maharsha, brings that in the conclusion, if the Reisha is speaking about a case where the Tam is because Mashe Tano Lo Hodulo, then the Zaklal at the end has to be teaching you something different than that. Bites Tam would have been learned from the Reisha already. And therefore, the Seifa is coming to teach you something newer, chidush, and that is bayit zeh. And even though the zeh klal at the end is not necessarily connected, because it's not the same reason as to why the things in the Braita fail, nevertheless, the Rashash points out that the Tosfot Yom Tov in Masechet Kelim notes that there are numerous cases like that where the zeh klal is disconnected from all the cases that were brought beforehand. But that does mean, and the Ritva writes this explicitly, that when it comes to a menorah of chuliot, or if it comes to a azurah, the laifa, if you have a menorah made out of assembled pieces, or a belt made out of sections, da'alo parech tamudah de laifa lo tani tana, all it says there is that it's not written in the braita, of a bi'ikara din, modina de chayavba. In the Ikar Adin, you would be chayav. In that case, it would be mashitono hodalo. V'chein koyotze ba, v'hap shita, the gdola k'tana, davar shemimido. And even if you use the terms big and small, as long as it's something that can be made from big to small, that would be considered davar shemimida, and would qualify as mode b'miksat. But in the end, the Breita is supportive of Rava because of the zehaklau. The zehaklau teaches you that not only the things mentioned in the Mishnah is this true, but there's an additional item, and that additional item means even by itzeh. Even in a case where you say by itzeh, it's not good enough to be considered a defined item, and it's not subject to modeh b'miksat. Alright, next Mishnah. Amalveh et chaveiro ala mashkon. Person lends money with collateral underlying it. Ve'avada mashkon. And then the collateral was lost. Amar lo, so he says to him, sela hil viticha alav. The creditor comes along and says, I lent you a sela worth of money, v'shekel haya shevet, and the collateral was worth a shekel, v'ala omer, lo. The debtor says, no way, ki ela sela yivitani alav, yes, you did lend me a sela, v'sela haya shevet, but the collateral was worth a sela, patur. In that case, he does not have to take a shvua. So just to, again, explain what a sela shekel, a sela in the Mishnah is equal to shekel of the Torah, and that is worth 4 dinar. The shekel of the Mishnah, which is over here, is half a sela, or 2 dinar. So here, the creditor comes along and says, I lent you a sela, which is 4 dinar. The collateral you gave me was worth a shekel, half a sela, or 2 dinar. You owe me the other 2 dinar. The debtor says back to him, no. You lent me a sela, which is worth 4 dinar, and the collateral was worth a sela, which is 4 dinar. I owe you nothing. That's the equivalent of kofer bakol. The creditor is making a claim for 2 dinar. The debtor says, I owe you absolutely nothing. That's kofer bakol. Sela hiviticha alav. The creditor says, I lent you a sela of 4 dinar. V'shekel hayashavet. And it was worth a shekel, half a sela or 2 dinar. V'hala omer. And the debtor says, lo. Ki ela sela hivitani alav. You lent me a sela, which is 4 dinar. U'shlosha dinarim hayashavet. And if the collateral was worth 3 dinar. So now, according to the creditor, there is a deficit of 2 dinar. He lent them a sela, which is 4 dinar. And the collateral was only worth a shekel, which is 2 dinar. There's a 2 dinar deficit. So the creditor is making a claim for 2 dinar. The debtor comes back and says, no. The loan was for 4 dinar a sela, but the collateral was worth 3 dinar, which means that I owe you a dinar. That is modeh b'miksat, because the creditor is asking for 2 dinar. And the debtor is saying, I only owe you a dinar. So it turns out, chayav, that would be a case where he's chayav in a shua, because he is modeh b'miksat. The next case is where the collateral is worth more than the loan. Sela v'itani alav, the debtor says, you lent me a sela, which is 4 dinar, ushtaim haya shaveh, and the collateral that you lost was worth 2 sela, double what you lent me. V'ala omer, and the creditor says, lo. I lent you a sela worth, and it was worth the sela of the collateral, patur. So over here, in this case, the debtor is making a claim that the creditor owes him money because he lost the collateral. He owes him 4 dinar. He owes him an extra sela. The creditor says, I owe you absolutely nothing. It was an offset between the mashkon and the debt outstanding, and therefore I owe you nothing. So that's a claim for 4 dinar and a denial of any owing, patur, because that's a kofer bakol. Sela hil vitani alav. The debtor says, you lent me a sela 4 dinar. Ushtayim haya shevet. And it was worth, the collateral was worth 2 sela. So now you owe me 4 dinar because you lost the collateral. Bala omer, and the creditor says, lo. Kela sela viticha alav. You're right. I lent you a sela which is 4 dinar. Vichamisha dinarim haya shevet. And the collateral was worth 5 dinar. So in this case, the creditor is saying, I owe you a dinar. I lent you 4, the collateral is worth 5, there's an excess dinar that I owe you. The debtor is making a claim for 2 sela, which means The collateral was 2 sela. The debt was a sela. That means there's a sela of excess. He's asking for 4 dinar in refund from the creditor. So he's making a claim for 4. The creditor's admitting to 1. That is chayav. That's a case of mode b'miktzat. Mi nishba. Who takes the shvua here? Mi shapikadon etzlo. Whoever is in possession of the pikadon. Shema yishavaze. Because what we're afraid of is that the other party will take the shvua. Yotzihala et a pikadon. And the other guy will pull out the pikadon and say, you were wrong, you lied. Rashi over here says, Yotzihala et a pikadon. Veshema lo dikdek ze b'shuma. And maybe the guy didn't try, wasn't so careful about the assessment. Veyifselenu le'edut ulishvua. And that will then make it that you are no longer trustworthy and you will lose your ability to testify or to take shvuot in the future, because now you're considered to be someone who lied under oath. So Rashi feels that the problem here, or the risk here, is that this individual is now going to lose his nemanut, is going to lose his believability, because he's going to be caught in a lie. Even though it might have not have been so intentional, even unintentionally, but he was caught in that lie. So the Balei HaTosafot say, that's the view of Rashi. If you look at the Rabbeinu Chananel, Rabbeinu Chananel says the same thing as Rashi over here. But he says, V'chi avdinan tekana v'rishe'e. He says, the Gemara Baba Metzia, the Rabbeinu Chananel says over there, that explanation doesn't make any sense. Because do you put a tekana in to protect Rishayim? If the guy lied under oath, then he shouldn't be believed anymore. What's the question over here? If you believe that he intentionally lied, and then we pull out the object, and he's caught in the lie, of course it should be pasul. So now you're saying, oh, we want to protect him from that? Why are you protecting him? He's a liar. If he's a liar, he should be caught in his lie, and then we wouldn't have to worry about this guy showing up in court anymore, because he'd lose his integrity in court. Ela taima, shema yotzihala pikadon, benimsa shvat love levatala. The problem here is not about lying and about the believability of the individual. It's simply a problem is, if he has the pikadon and he forces the other guy to take his shvua, it's a shvua levatala. It's an unnecessary shvua that didn't need to be taken because he had the pikadon. The way that the Rif expresses it is that it's a problem of shem shamayim levatala, and you can read that in either way, which means that you can read it like Rashi and you can read it like the Balei HaTosafot. You can read it like the Balei HaTosafot, shem shamayim levatala. It's a problem that you're taking a shvua that's unnecessary. Or, if you read it like Rashi, which is, in the end, he turns out that he didn't tell the truth. However unintentional it was, he didn't tell the truth. It means he used the Shem Shamayim, Levatala, or the Shav. And so you can read the Rif's view in either one of Rashi or the Balei HaTosafot. So, but here you see a difference between Rashi saying that the problem is a problem of getting caught in a lie and then this individual losing his integrity. But the Balei HaTosafot would say, why not? If he is a liar, let him lose his believability. The problem here is that you're going to take an unnecessary shvua. All right, the Gemara says, aye. That last line in the Mishnah, which of the 4 cases in the Mishnah was it referencing? You have 4 cases in the Mishnah. 2 of them are kofar bakol, 2 of them are modeh b'miktzat. And then you have a statement at the end of the Mishnah that says, who takes the shvua? Misha pikadon etzlo. What is that referring to? Ilei ma'aseifa, if you think it's speaking about the latter part of the Mishnah, but typically the shvua gabe malveh. You don't need to say that because the claimant in the latter half of the Mishnah is the debtor. The debtor says his collateral exceeded the value of the loan, and he's making a claim against the creditor. The creditor is either a kofar bakol, or he's a modeh b'miktzat. The person taking the shvua anyway is the malveh. So why do you need that statement at the end of the Mishnah and say, oh, whoever the pikadon is with takes the shvua? The malveh is taking the shvua anyway because he's the one who is modeh b'miktzat. So Amar Shmuel Aresha. It must be going on the first half of the Mishnah, where we're speaking about the debtor who is the modeh b'miktzat. It's going on the first part. Again, my resha. What is the first part of the Mishnah? The first case in the Mishnah is a kofar bakol case. So that can't be what you're speaking about. Seifa deresha. It must be the second case of the Mishnah, which is the latter part of the first half of the Mishnah. Sela hilviticha alav. The creditor says, I lent you a sela for dinar, the shekel ayashaveh, and the collateral was worth a shekel, 2 dinar, half the amount, and that means you owe me 2 dinar, v'halah omer, and the debtor says, lo, kela sela hil vitani alav, yes, you did lend me a sela, which is 4 dinar, Vishlosha dinarim ayashaveh. And the collateral was worth 3 dinar, which means I only owe you 1 dinar. The creditor is making a claim for 2 dinar. The debtor is saying, I owe you 1 dinar. Kayav, that is a shwa, the modeh b'miksat. And that shwa would be on the debtor. The shwa gave lovehi. That's the debtor's shwa. Vishaklur rabbanan mi loveh. The rabbanan took it from the loveh. Vishadua al malveh. And threw it onto the malveh, the misha pikadon etzlo. So that last line in the Mishnah is a reference to the second case in the Mishnah, where the debtor is now obligated to take a shwa modeh b'miksat, and we flip it onto the malveh to protect against the problem of the malveh suddenly pulling out the pikadon after the loveh took the shvuah. Now, the Rimi Gash points out over here that all of this is true only if the loveh believes the malveh. The malveh, as we're going to see in a second, is considered to be a shomer, not only a shomer, but a shomer sechar. A shomer sechar has to then take a shvuah to substantiate their position. Not about the Geneva of Aveda, because Rosh Hashanah Sechar is Chayav in Geneva of Aveda, but it's like a Shvah Shalosh Shalach Yado B'Melechet Reyu, that he didn't take it for himself, that he didn't do anything untoward to the object that caused the problem. If the Rimi Gash says, if he already has to take a Shvah Shalosh Shalach Yado, then we, through Gilgul Shvah, we'd force the individual also take a Shvah about the value of the Pikadon. So the Rimi Gash points out that you don't even need this whole line in the Mishnah, if the Loveh doesn't believe the Malveh. Because then the Malveh creditor would have to take a Shvua, that Shalosh Shalach Yado, B'Melechet Reyu, for the Mashkon. Once he's doing that, we'd force him to take a Shvua about the value. So the case is where the Loveh believes the Malveh didn't do anything untoward, and it was stolen, or it was lost. And in that case, where there's no need for a Shvua, except for the Modeh B'Miksat, the Loveh would have been Chayav in the Shvua. That's where we flip it onto the Malveh. Vashto Dama Ravashi. Now the Ravashi says, it's from the Gemara in Boba Mitzia, the Kaimalan Zenishba Sheina Birshuto, that one of them takes a Shvua that it's not in his possession, the Zenishba Kama Shaveh, and this one takes the Shvua as to the value, Hachi Kamar. This is what's meant by the Mishnah. The Gemara in Boba Mitzia asks, if you have to take a Shvua Sheina Birshuto, Ravashi says there's a necessity for a shomer to take a shvua that it's not in his possession. What we're afraid of is, the shomer is going to lie and take it for himself. He doesn't want to steal. He's an honest, quote-unquote, guy. So what he wants to do is pay for the object, but he likes the object. So what he does is he says it was stolen or it was lost. As a shomer sechar, he's chayav to pay for that. He's fine, I'll pay for it, because he wants the object. So what we're worried about now is by shomerim, that they will lie and pay for it because they want to keep the object. So what we have the shomer do is take a shvua she'ena birshuto. The shomer has to take a shvua that is no longer in his possession. And in essence, he's not playing this game by saying it's gneva v'aveda and paying for it, and that way purchasing, quote-unquote, the object through that claim. But once he does that, how do you deal with our Mishnah? If the guy's taking a shvua she'ena birshuto, there's no need to flip the shvua from the loveh to the malveh. The malveh, who was the shomer over the pikadon, the mashkon, he's taking a shvua that's not his possession. Once he takes a shvua that's not his possession, he can't pull it out later and then catch the guy in his shvua. So then, okay, there's no reason to flip the shvua in our Mishnah. So the explanation of Ravashi is, Dama Ravashi, the kaimalan, zenishba sheno birshuto, zenishba kama shaveh. V'hachi kamar. This is what's meant in the Mishnah. Mi nishba tchila. Who has to take the shvua first? Mi shapikadon etzlo. Whoever has the pikadon. So what Rav Ashi does in the end to reconcile with our Mishnah is say that yes, the malveh, the shomer of the pikadon, or here the mashkon, will have to take a shvua sheno birshuto. Once he does that, that would negate the necessity for us to flip the shvua. So the meaning of the Mishnah is not that you have to flip the Shvua. The meaning of the Mishnah is who takes the Shvua first. Is it the creditor or is it the debtor? So we say the creditor takes the Shvua first in order to prevent the problem of the debtor taking a Shvua about the value of the Pikadon or the Mashkon. Then all of a sudden the creditor pulls it out. So we have the creditor take the Shvua first that the collateral is no longer in his possession. Once we have that established, then the debtor can take his Shvua to establish the price, because we're no longer afraid of the creditor pulling it out. He took a shvua that he doesn't have it in his possession. If he pulls it out now, he's lost all credibility, and it won't matter because he lied under oath about not having it in his possession. And so therefore, according to Rav Ashi, that is the reasoning. Shemi Shabazev, Yotzi Halat HaPikadon, is explained about priority in sequence, who takes the Shvuah first, not about flipping the Shvuah to the other party. Amar Shmuel, Hai man de osfe alfa zuze de chabre. Person who lends 1,000 zuz to his friend, 1,000 dinar, o mashkan le kata de maglo. And he took as collateral the handle of the scythe or the handle of the axe. He took a wooden handle as collateral. There is no value equality between the collateral that he took and the loan that was extended. The handle is worth a couple of zuz. Meantime, he lent them 1,000 zuz. Obviously, he took the collateral as representative value, not at its true value. The true value of this object has no match to the actual item. So he either took the collateral because he knows the guy wants it back, and therefore he's going to want his handle and he'll pay the money back, or he took it as what's called zichron devarim, that he wanted to remember that the loan was outstanding. Avad kata demaglo, if he loses the collateral, avad alfa zuze. Shmuel says he loses the entire loan. So Rashi explains that over here. This savar vekabil. The guy accepted it. When he accepted the collateral, he accepted that it was only representative value and not true value. That means he thinks the mashkon is offset against the loan. Aval kozman jein kayamin. As long as the collateral is around, al korcho govea chovo. Against the will of the debtor, he will collect his loan. What Rashi is pointing out is that there's a difference between collateral lost and collateral as payment. What Rashi says is the guy, when he took the collateral of the handle of whatever it is, he did not accept that as payment or repayment of his loan. So if the debtor defaults on the loan, and now there's this collateral here, it doesn't mean that the debtor can say to him, listen, you have the collateral, you accepted it as representative value for the whole loan, I paid you back, we're done now. He can't do that. He did not accept it as a pure own. He did not accept it as repayment. What he did accept it as was a collateral until the repayment of the loan. If he loses it during that period of time, then he's lost his whole loan because he can't return the mashkon in order to collect the debt, and the two were offsetting against each other. He accepted it as representative value. On the other hand, if at the time that the loan expires, he shows up and hands him the collateral back, at that point, the debtor can't default and say, take the collateral. He's going to have to pay him the full amount. And that's what Shmuel's din has come to teach you. If you lose the collateral, then you've also lost the loan. Aval, tarte katate lo. If he handed him 2 handles, then that's not the case. The way that Rashi explains this is, we don't say that when he hands him 2 handles, that we look at it at representative value. One's worth 500 and one is worth 500. If he doesn't have the value there, what's the difference of taking 1 handle or 2 handles? It makes no difference at all. And therefore, he's already taking 2 handles. That means that he's looking at the underlying value of the object and not representative value. And therefore, the 2 handles are classified as a single mashkon and not each one representing half the loan. That means as long as you return a part of the mashkon, the remainder or residual will just assess at its true value and you won't lose the whole loan. If you lose both of them and you can't return anything, then you'll lose the whole loan. But if you only lose one, since you've returned a portion of the mashkon, you're entitled to get your full repayment. And the remaining handle, you'll just deduct its true value from the money that is owed to you. Rav Nachman amar, afilu tarte katate, avad chada, avad chameshmiyon, avad idach, avad kulek. Rav Nachman says that when you take 2 representative values, things that have no correlation with the value of the loan that's extended, that means that you accepted each one as representative value, and you divide it up. 1 handle represents half the loan, and the other handle represents the other half of the loan. You lose one, you lose half the loan. Lose the other one, you lose the remainder of the loan. They're each one now deemed to have a value of half the loan, or 500 dinar. Aval, but Rav Nachman agrees that if you took kata v'naska loan, if you took a handle and metal, then not. Over here, what Rashi notes is that the handle itself has only representative value. Nobody takes the handle as a form of payment. On the other hand, when it comes to the naschot, when it comes to the metallic item, people accept that as currency or repayment. Or in essence, what Rashi says is the differentiation that I made for you before between the collateral being representative value as collateral but not being something that can be used as repayment, that is not true by Nasca. By Nasca, the person would accept that as repayment at its true value or at its fair value. And that means that he's accepting the Nasca not as representative value, but as real value. If you default on the loan, he would keep the Nasca at its value as repayment for whatever amount it is of the loan. Based on that, that means that you now have two items here. You have one item that only has representative value. You have another item that has true value. Since the other item has true value, then we don't look at the kata as having representative value. We look at them all as having just true value. And therefore, if you lose them, you don't lose the loan. The Baal Tosafot do not like Rashi's explanation. Rashi says the difference between kata and nascha is that kata always is representative value. Nascha is true value because people would accept it as peer owned. People would accept it as repayment. Therefore, nobody would accept it at its representative value. And you can see that in the Baal Tosafot, on kata and nascha, perish b'kudshes, came in nascha b'pidroni, lo kiblo alei, ela b'dmei shavya. Because it is a currency or something that people would accept as repayment, therefore, it's treated like its true value, not as representative value. Bekasha, the samuch parich mimetniten amai chayav. But Tosafot does not like Rashi's explanation because the upcoming Gemara is going to ask from our Mishnah, my kushya, shmul modev emitit bar pirion. And in the case of the Mishnah, it's speaking about what is otherwise a nascha, or something that would be valued at pirion. The Tosafot at first tries to reconcile with Rashi and suggest that this is the position of Rav Nachman. He says, "Bedochak yesh lechalek, the modi Rav Nachman bechad nascha betray nascha, aval nascha b'hadekata muchr milta dekata lemashkon benascha lepiron." He's saying that the way to deal with Rashi is to say that it's all because of the contrast between the kata and the nascha. If you just had nascha, in Ochanami, Rav Nachman might agree that those items are representative value. The only point is here, when you have contrasting items, nascha in contrast to the kata makes it clear that you're not accepting representative value and only true value. Venira the Faresh. And now the Baal Tosafot gives other options. Elavad kochad the fi mai de shavye. Dimanascha shavye eser kate. He says that what Rav Nachman is saying is that they do not have the same representative value. When you have a handle and a handle, each handle is then representative of half the loan, 500 and 500. He says here where there's such a great disparity between the handle and the metal, then you have to look at it on a relative basis. If the handle is worth 1/11 and the handle is worth 10/11, you're going to split the loan along those lines, which is that if you lose the handle, you lose 1/11 of the loan. If you lose nascha, you're going to lose 10/11 of the loan. And that's what's meant over here. You look at their relative value to each other, and then to figure out what their representative value is vis-a-vis the loan. So that's the way the Baal Tosafot like to explain Rav Nachman. The Faresh kat v'nascha lo, v'yavad kata lo avad palga, elamay d'shobi. D'ikar smicha d'milve ala nascha, avad nascha avad kulhu. So then he gives another answer, which is a possibility that the nascha is what he's really relying on. And therefore the nascha becomes a representative value to the whole loan. So if you lose the handle, you lose its true value. You lose the nascha, you're going to lose your whole loan, even though it doesn't equal up to the loan, because it's so much more significant than the handle, that that's definitely what he is relying on as the representative value. So that's another way to explain it. Tosafot gives two alternatives to Rashi's view. Rashi's view is whether you would accept it as repayment or not, and that determines whether you accept it at its true value or representative value. The Baal Tosafot give two answers. One is that when he says aval kata v'nascha lo, it just means that we don't accept them as being equal partners in the mashkon. Each one will get its relative representative value through its underlying true value. Or the other way Tosafot learn is that nascha would be representative of the whole loan, and the kata is just the sidebar because it's so insignificant to the nascha. Afilu kata v'nascha. Even a kata nascha is considered to be representative value of a nascha, of a palga. You lose the metal, you lose half the loan. Of a kata, of a kula, you're going to lose the remainder of it. It's none. Our Mishnah presents a problem for that. Sela yiviticha alav. Creditor says, I lent you a sela. The shekel ayah shaveh. And the underlying collateral was worth a shekel or half the amount. No, you lent me a sela for dinar, v'shlosha dinarim ayah shaveh. And it was worth 3 dinar, so he's modeh that he owes a dinar. whereas the creditor is looking for 2 dinar. Chayav, that's motive of miksat. Lemalei hakabilte. Why don't you just say to the guy, you accepted it. You took the item, it was worth less than the loan. That's representative value. You lost it. You lost the whole loan over here. Why doesn't Shmuel's din apply? This is a significant question on Shmuel's din. Gemara answers, Matznitan b'deparish, Shmuel b'deloparish. This is the girsa of Rashi in the Gemara, that the case of the Mishnah is a case where he said, I will only accept the collateral at its true value. Shmuel is the default situation. The default situation is where you receive a mashkon, receive collateral that is sub-value to the actual loan, then we assume it's representative value. You lose it, you lost the loan. If you specify that you're only accepting this item at its true value, which is less than the value of the loan, then in that case, you will not lose the loan when you lose the object. And that's why Rashi explains it, that the Mishnah is b'deparish, where he specifies that that is the true value, and Shmuel is where he is not parish, and that's the default situation, which is that you'll accept it as representative value. If you look in the Bein Hanan over here, the Bein Hanan has the opposite girsa of Rashi. He says, Matnitin b'delo parish. Our Mishnah is a case where he did not specify it. Ki armar Shmuel v'Rav Nachman v'Nardai b'de parish. And the case of Shmuel and all the other Amoraim is a case where he was mifarish. B'amar, afagav d'lo shaveh hanidmei kabiltei. Even though it's not worth that true value, I accept it. So what the Rabbeinu Hananel says, as opposed to Rashi, is that the default situation is that when you take a mashkon, it's accepted at its true value. Only if the guy accepts it as representative value, will then he be held accountable for the fact that he lost it and then he loses the loan. So machloket in the girsaot between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Hananel is what is the default scenario? For Rashi, the default scenario is you accept it as representative value. You need to declare that you're accepting it at true value in order for it to be true value. Rabbeinu Hananel learns just the opposite. Rabbeinu Hananel says, you accept it by default at its true value. You want to accept it at representative value? Then you got to specify, or that's got to be determined up front. And you look in the Baalei Tosafot, Rabbeinu Tam Gari Sipcha. Rabbeinu Tam also flips the gear, so like the Rabbeinu Hananel, but his language is that the individual accepts the fact that if he loses the mashkon, he's going to lose the whole loan. Chayin Rabbeinu Tam, umuki Shmuel v'deparish. And the case of Shmuel is where you specify it. Dein svarah lafsid l'malveh kol chovo l'gamrei heched lo parish. If it was never stated explicitly, what basis do you have to say that the creditor should lose his whole loan just because he lost the collateral? But then the Baalei HaTosafot question that and say, wait a minute, if you set it up as being a case where he's mifaresh, first of all, then what's the chiddush of Shmuel? If it's all explicitly stated in the agreement between them, then what does Shmuel tell you? That he loses the whole loan. That was already accepted up front. And number two is, then how do you explain in the upcoming Gemara, if he specified that it's going to be representative value, why would Rabbi Eliezer disagree? Why would Rabbi Eliezer say that Shmuel's din doesn't apply? If you specify that you're accepting it as representative value, who could argue on that? That's an acceptance. That's a contractual obligation that you came to. The Baalei Tosafot give two possible answers. One answer is, Be'ish Lomar. Now Tosafot now goes on to explain this next piece of the Gemara in a differentiated way, which is, Kasavar Abelezer, Dasmachta bi'almahi. Vafilu k'neged ha-mashkon lo mafsid. That Rabbi Eliezer thinks that the agreement is an asmachta, that it's not a full-fledged kinyan, because the person here is exaggerating the value, also relying on the fact that he's not going to lose the mashkon, and when he entered into the transaction, he never believed that this would be the outcome of the transaction. And that's what we would call an asmachta, and he believes asmachta lo kanyo. Vodesh tomar, and then the Baalei Tosafot offer another alternative, if you don't want to say they're arguing an asmachta, the Balav Asmachta Plige, Uparish, Lavainu Shapirish, Vedya Shefsid Kolachol, which is not like the wording of the Rabbeinu Tam, but rather closer to the wording of the Rabbeinu Hananel, which is like the Rabbeinu Hananel just says, that he accepted it, even though it's not worth the value of the loan. He never states explicitly, if he loses it, he'll lose the whole loan. He simply says that I accept it as a collateral, even though it's not worth the whole loan. And Shmuel's Chiddush is that when you do that, it becomes representative value and equal to the entire loan. If you lose it, you lose the whole loan. So now, this also has nafka mino klalocha, depending on which way you think the din of Shmuel goes. Rashi thinks the case of Shmuel is the lo parish, and the Rabbeinu Kananos thinks that the din of Shmuel is bidde parish. Coming up in the Gemara is going to move back and forth about whether there's a makloket tanaim within Shmuel or not within Shmuel, and that will have impact on where you think the halacha is going, and we'll discuss it tomorrow as we move through the Gemara, because you need to know the next piece of the Gemara in order to understand that. But that's what the end of the Baalei Tosafot discuss over here, is the halacha like Shmuel, or is the halacha not like Shmuel in this instance. Okay, we're going to stop here 8 lines from the bottom of Mem Gimel Amud Bet, because the remainder of the Gemara continues all the way into tomorrow's Amud.